wandering, demented with disease. I saw her in her mirror, shrieking. "All you need to do is get him talking, a little bit at a time," Janet went on. "You know, act reluctant, as if he's caught you unaware. Otherwise he'll get suspicious. Build it up for a few days, while we try to find out where he is. Get on AOL. Go into the chat rooms and find one called ME, okay? Just hang out in there." "Then what?" I wanted to know. "The hope is he'll come looking for you, thinking this is where you do consultations with other doctors, scientists. He won't be able to resist. That's Wesley's theory, and I agree with it." "Does he know I'm here?" The question was ambiguous, but she knew who I meant. "Yes," she said. "Marino asked me to call him."
"What did he say?"
I asked into the phone. "He wanted to know if you were okay." She was getting evasive. "He has this old case in Georgia. Something about two people stabbed to death in a liquor store and organized crime is involved. In a little town near St. Simon's Island."
"Oh.
So he's on the road?"
"I guess so."
"Where will you be?"
"With the squad. I'll actually be staying in Baltimore, on the harbor."
"And Lucy?" I asked again, this time in a way she couldn't evade. "Do you want to tell me what's really going on, Janet?" I breathed my filtered air, looking through glass at someone I knew could never lie to me. "Everything okay?" I pressed harder.
"Dr. Scarpetta, I'm here by myself for two reasons," she finally said. "First, Lucy and I got into a huge fight about your going online with this guy. So everyone involved thought it would be better if she wasn't the one to talk to you about it."
"I can understand that," I said, "and I agree."
"My second reason is a far more unpleasant one," she went on. "It's about Carrie Greffin."
I was astonished and enraged at the mere mention of her name. Years ago, when Lucy was developing Kane, she had worked with Carrie. Then ERF had been broken into, and Carrie had seen to it that my niece was blamed. There were murders, too, sadistic and terrible, that Carrie had been accomplice to with a psychopathic man.
"She's still in prison," I said.
"I know. But her trial is scheduled for the spring," Janet said.
"I'm well aware of that."
I didn't understand what she was getting at.
"You're the key witness. Without you, the Commonwealth doesn't have much of a case. At least, not when you're talking about a jury trial."
"Janet, I am most confused," I said, and my headache was back with fury.
She took a deep breath.
"I'm sure you must be aware that there was a time when Lucy and Carrie were close." She hesitated.
"Very close."
"Of course," I impatiently said. "Lucy was a teenager and Carrie seduced her. Yes, yes, I know all about it."
"So does Percy Ring."
I looked at her, shocked.
"It seems that yesterday, Ring went to see the CA, who's prosecuting the case. Rob Shermer. Ring tells him, one buddy to another, that he's got a major problem since the star witness's niece had an affair with the defendant."
"My God in heaven!" I couldn't believe this.
"That fucking bastard!"
I was a lawyer. I knew what this meant. Lucy would have to take the stand and be questioned about her affair with another woman. The only way to avoid this was for me to be struck as a witness, allowing Carrie to get away with murder. What she did has nothing to do with Carrie's crimes, I said, so angry with Ring I felt capable of violence. Janet switched the phone to her other ear, trying to be smooth, but I could see her fear. I don't need to tell you how it is out there, she said. Don't ask, don't tell. It's not tolerated, no matter what anybody says. Lucy and I are so careful. People may suspect, but they don't really know, and it's not like we walk around in leather and chains. Not hardly. I think this would ruin her, she matter-of-factly stated. The publicity. And I can't imagine HRT when she shows up after that. All those big guys. Ring's just doing this to do her in. And maybe you too. And maybe me. This won't exactly help my career either. She didn't need to go on. I understood. Does anyone know what Shermer's response was when Ring told him? He freaked. Called Marino and said he didn't know what he was going to do, that when the defense found out, he was cooked. Then Marino called me. Marino has said nothing to me. He didn't want to upset you right now, she said. And he didn't think it was his place. I see, I said. Does Lucy know? I told her. And? She kicked a hole in the bedroom wall, Janet answered. Then she said if she had to, she'd take the stand. Janet pressed her palm against the glass, spreading her fingers, waiting for me to do the same. It was as close as we could get to touching, and my eyes teared up. I feel as if I've committed a crime, I said, clearing my throat. Chapter 10. The nurse carried the computer equipment into my room and wordlessly handed it to me before walking right back out. For a moment, I stared at the laptop as if it were something that might hurt me. I was sitting up in bed, where I continued to perspire profusely while I was cold at the same time. I didn't know if the way I felt was due to a microbe or if I were having some sort of emotional attack because of what Janet had just told me. Lucy had wanted to be an FBI agent since she was a child, and she was already one of the best ones they'd ever had. This was so unfair. She had done nothing but make the mistake of being drawn in by someone evil when she was only 19. I was desperate to get out of this room and find her. I wanted to go home. I was about to ring for the nurse when one walked in. She was new. "Do you suppose I could have a fresh set of scrubs?" I asked her. "I can get you a gown." "Scrubs, please." "Well, it's a little out of the ordinary." She frowned. "I know." I plugged the computer into the telephone jack and pushed a button to turn it on. "If they don't get beyond this budget impasse soon, there won't be anybody to autoclave scrubs or anything else." The nurse kept talking in her blue suit, arranging covers over my legs. "On the news this morning, the president said Meals on Wheels is going broke. EPA isn't cleaning up toxic waste dumps. Federal courts may close and forget getting a tour of the White House. You ready for lunch?" "Thank you," I said, as she continued her litany of bad news. "Not to mention Medicaid, air pollution, and tracking the winter flu epidemic or screening water supplies for the Cryptosporidium parasite. You're just lucky you're here now. Next week, we might not be open." I didn't even want to think about budget feuds, since I devoted most of my time to them, haggling with department heads and firing at legislators during General Assembly. I worried that when the federal crisis slammed down to the state level, My new building would never be finished. My meager current funding further ruthlessly slashed. There were no lobbyists for the dead. My patients had no party and didn't vote.
You got two choices, she was saying.
I'm sorry. I tuned her in again. Chicken or ham?
Chicken.
I wasn't the least bit hungry.
And hot tea.
She unplugged her airline and left me to the quiet. I set the laptop on the tray and logged onto America Online. I went straight to my mailbox. There was plenty, but nothing from Dead Doc that Squad 19 hadn't already opened. I followed menus to the chat rooms, pulled up a list of the member rooms, and checked to see how many people were in the one called ME. No one was there. So I went in alone and leaned back against my pillows, staring at the blank screen with its row of icons across the top. Literally, there was no one to chat with. And I thought of how ridiculous this must seem to Dead Doc, were he somehow watching. Wasn't it obvious if I were alone in a room? Wouldn't it seem that I was waiting? I had no sooner entertained this thought when a sentence was written across my screen and I began to answer. Quincy. Hi. What are we talking about today?
Scarpetta.
The budget impasse. How is it affecting you?
Quincy.
I work out of the D.C. office. A nightmare.
Scarpetta.
Are you a medical examiner?
Quincy.
Right. We've met at meetings. We know some of the same people. Not much of a crowd today, but it could always get better if one is patient.
That's when I knew Quincy was one of the undercover agents from Squad 19. We continued our session until lunch arrived, then resumed it afterwards for the better part of an hour. Quincy and I chatted about our problems, asking questions about solutions, anything we could think of that might seem like normal conversation between medical examiners or people they might confer with. But Dead Doc didn't bite. I took a nap and woke up a little past 4. For a moment, I lay very still, forgetting where I was. Then it came back to me with depressing alacrity. I sat up, cramped beneath my tray, the computer still open on top of it. I logged on to AOL again and went back into the chat room. This time, I was joined by someone who called himself MedX, and we talked about the type of computer database I used in Virginia for capturing case information and doing statistical retrievals. At exactly 5 minutes past 5, a bell sounded off-key inside my computer, and the instant message window suddenly dominated my screen. I stared in disbelief as a communication from Dead Doc appeared, words that I knew no one else in the chat room could see.
Dead Doc, you think you're so smart.
Scarpetta,
who are you?
Dead Doc.
You know who I am. I am what you do.
Scarpetta.
What do I do?
Dead Doc.
Death. Dr. Death. You are me.
Scarpetta. I am not you.
Dead Doc. You think you're so smart.
He abruptly got quiet, and when I clicked on the available button, it showed that he had logged off. My heart was racing as I sent another message to MedX, saying I had been tied up with a visitor. I got no response, finding myself alone in the chat room again. Damn, I exclaimed under my breath. I tried again as late as 10 p.m., but no one appeared except Quincy again, to tell me we should try another meeting in the morning.
All of the other docs, he said, had gone home. The same nurse checked on me, and she was sweet. I felt sorry for her long hours and her inconvenience of having to wear a blue suit every time she came into my room. "Where is the new shift?" I asked as she took my temperature.
"I'm it. We're all just doing the best we can."
I nodded as she alluded to the furlough yet one more time this day.
"There's hardly a lab worker here," she went on. "You could wake up tomorrow, the only person in the building."
"Now I'm sure to have nightmares," I said, as she wrapped the BP cuff around my arm.
"Well, you're feeling okay, and that's the important thing."
Ever since I started coming down here, I started imagining I was getting one thing or another, the slightest ache or pain or sniffle, and it's, "Oh my God, so what kind of doctor are you?"
I told her.
"I was going to be a pediatrician. Then I got married.
We'd be in a lot of trouble were it not for good nurses like you," I smiled and said.
"Most doctors never bother to notice that. They have these attitudes."
"Some of them certainly do," I agreed.
I tried to go to sleep and was restless throughout the night. Streetlights from the parking lot beyond my window seeped through the blinds, and no matter which way I turned, I couldn't relax. It was hard to breathe, and my heart wouldn't slow down. At 5 a.m., I finally sat up and turned on my light. Within minutes, the nurse was back inside my room.
"You all right?"
She looked exhausted.
"Can't sleep."
"Want something?"
I turned on the computer as I shook my head. I logged onto AOL and went back to the chat room, which was empty. Clicking on the available button, I checked to see if Dead Doc was online, and if so, where he might be. There was no sign of him, and I began scrolling through the various chat rooms available to subscribers and their families. There was truly something for everyone. Places for flirts, singles, gays, lesbians, Native Americans, African Americans, and for evil. People who preferred bondage, sadomasochism, group sex, bestiality, incest, were welcome to find each other and exchange pornographic art. The FBI could do nothing about it. All of it was legal. Dejected, I sat up, propped against my pillows, and, without intending to, dozed off. When I opened my eyes again an hour later, I was in a chat room called Art Love. A message was quietly waiting for me on my screen. Dead Doc had found me.
Dead Doc. A picture's worth a thousand words. I hastily checked to see if he was still logged on, and found him quietly coiled in cyberspace, waiting for me. I typed my response.
"Scarpetta,
what are you trading?" He didn't respond right away. I sat staring at the screen for 3 or 4 minutes. Then he was back.
"Dead Doc, I don't trade with traitors. I give freely. What do you think happens to people like that?"
"Scarpetta, why don't you tell me?" Silence, and I watched as he left the room, and a minute later was back. He was breaking the trace. He knew exactly what we were doing.
"Dead Doc, I think you know."
"Scarpetta, I don't."
"Dead Doc, you will."
"Scarpetta, I saw the photos you sent. They weren't very clear. What was your point?" But he didn't answer, and I felt slow and dull-witted.
I had him and could not engage him. I couldn't keep him on. I was feeling frustrated and discouraged when another instant message appeared on my screen. This one from the squad again. Quincy. A.K.A. Scarpetta. Still need to go over that case with you. The self-immolation. That's when I realized that Quincy was Lucy. A.K.A. was Aunt Kay Always, her code for me. She was watching over me, as I had watched over her all these years. And she was telling me not to go up in flames. I typed a message back. Scarpetta, I agree. Your case is very troublesome. How are you handling it? Quincy, just watch me in court. More later. I smiled as I signed off and leaned back in the pillows. I didn't feel quite so alone or crazed.
Good morning.
The first nurse was back. Same to you. My spirits dipped lower.
Let's check those vitals. How are we feeling today?
We're fine.
You've got a choice of eggs or cereal?
Fruit, I said.
That wasn't a choice, but we can probably scrape up a banana.
The thermometer went into my mouth, the cuff around my arm. All the while, she kept talking.
It's so cold out it could snow, she was saying. 34 degrees. You believe that? I had frost on my windshield. The acorns are big this year.
That always means a severe winter.
You're still not even up to 98 degrees yet.
What's wrong with you? Why wasn't the phone left in here? I asked.
I'll ask about it.
She took the cuff off.
Blood pressure's low, too.
Please ask Colonel Fujitsubo to stop by this morning. She stood back and scrutinized me.
You going to complain about me?
Good heavens, no, I said. I just need to leave.
Well, I hate to tell you, but that's not up to me. Some people stay in here as long as 2 weeks.
I would lose my mind, I thought. The colonel didn't appear before lunch, which was a broiled chicken breast, carrots, and rice. I hardly ate as my tension mounted, and the TV flashed silently in the background because I had turned off the sound. The nurse came back at 2 p.m. and announced I had another visitor. So I put on the HEPA filter mask again and followed her back down the hall into the clinic. This time I was in booth A, and Wesley was waiting for me on the other side. He smiled when our eyes met, and both of us picked up our phones. I was so relieved and surprised to see him that I stammered at first. "I hope you've come to rescue me," I said. "I don't take on doctors. You taught me that."
"I thought you were in Georgia."
"I was. Took a look at the liquor store where the two people were stabbed, scouted around the area in general. Now I'm here."
"And?"
"And?"
He raised an eyebrow.
"Organized crime."
"I wasn't thinking about Georgia."
"Tell me what you are thinking. I seem to be losing the art of mind reading. And you look particularly lovely today, let me add," he said to my mask.
"I'm going to go crazy if I don't get out of here soon," I said. "I've got to get to CDC.
Lucy tells me you've been communicating with Dead Doc." The playful light vanished from his eyes. "To no great extent and with not much luck," I angrily said. To communicate with this killer was infuriating, for it was exactly what he wanted. I had made it my mission in life not to reward people like him. "Don't give up," Wesley said.
He makes allusions to medical matters, such as diseases and germs, I said. Doesn't this concern you in light of what's going on?
He no doubt follows the news. He made the same point Janet had.
But what if it's more than that? I asked. The woman he dismembered seems to have the same disease that the victim from Tangier does.
And you can't verify that yet.
You know, I didn't get where I am by making assumptions and leaping to conclusions. I was getting very out of sorts. I will verify this disease as soon as I can, but I think we should be guided by common sense in the meantime.
I'm not certain I understand what you're saying.
His eyes never left mine. I'm saying that we might be dealing with biological warfare. A Unabomber who uses a disease.
I hope to God we're not.
But the thought has crossed your mind, too. Don't tell me you think that a fatal disease somehow linked with a dismemberment is coincidental. I studied his face, and I knew he had a headache. The same vein on his forehead always stood out like a bluish rope.
"And you're sure you're feeling all right?" he said.
"Yes. I'm more worried about you.
What about this disease? What about the risk to you?"
He was getting irritated with me, the way he always did when he thought I was in danger.
"I've been revaccinated."
"You've been vaccinated for smallpox," he said.
"What if that's not what it is?"
"Then we're in a world of trouble."
"Janet came by." "I know," he said into his phone. "I'm sorry. The last thing you needed right now..."
"No, Benton," I interrupted him. "I had to be told. There's never a good time for news like that. What do you think will happen?"
But he didn't want to say.
"Then you think it will ruin her, too," I said in despair.
"I doubt she'll be terminated. What usually happens is you stop getting promoted, get lousy assignments, field offices out in the middle of nowhere. She and Janet will end up 3,000 miles apart. One or both will quit."
"How's that better than being fired?" I said in pained outrage.
"We'll take it as it comes, Kay."
He looked at me.
"I'm dismissing Ring from Caskew."
"Be careful what you do because of me."
"It's done," he said.
Fujitsubo didn't stop by my room again until early the next morning, and then he was smiling and opening blinds to let in sunlight so dazzling it hurt my eyes.
"Good morning, and so far so good," he said. "I'm very pleased that you do not seem to be getting sick on us, Kay."
"Then I can go," I said, ready to leap out of bed right then.
"Not so fast."
He was reviewing my chart.
"I know how hard this is for you, but I'm not comfortable letting you go quite so soon. Stick it out a little longer, and you can leave the day after tomorrow, if all goes well."
I felt like crying when he left, because I didn't see how I could endure one more hour of quarantine. Miserable, I sat up under the covers and looked out at the day. The sky was bright blue, with wisps of clouds beneath the pale shadow of a morning moon. Trees beyond my window were bare and rocking in a gentle wind. I thought of my home in Richmond, of plants to be potted, and work piling up on my desk. I wanted to take a walk in the cold, to cook broccoli and homemade barley soup. I wanted spaghetti with ricotta, or stuffed frittata, and music and wine. For half the day, I simply felt sorry for myself
and did not do a thing except stare at television and doze. Then the nurse for the next shift came in with the phone and said there was a call for me. I waited until it was transferred and snatched up the receiver as if this were the most exciting thing that had ever happened in my life. "It's me," Lucy said. "Thank God." I was thrilled to hear her voice. "Gran says hi. Rumor has it that you win the Bad Patient Award." The rumor is accurate. All the work in my office, if only I had it here. "You need to rest," she said, "to keep your defenses up." This made me worry about Wingo again. "How come you haven't been on the laptop?" She then got to the point. I was quiet. "Aunt Kay, he's not going to talk to us. He's only going to talk to you." "Then one of you sign on as me," I replied. "No way. If he senses that's what's going on, we lose him for good. This guy is scary. He's so clever." My silence was my comment, and Lucy rushed to fill it. "What?" she said with feeling. "I'm supposed to pretend I'm a forensic pathologist with a law degree who's already worked at least one of this guy's cases? I don't think so." "I don't want to connect with him, Lucy," I said. "People like him get off on that. They want it. Want the attention. The more I play his game, the more it might encourage him. Have you thought about that?" "Yes. But think about this. Whether he's dismembered one person or 20, he's going to do something else bad. People like him don't just stop. And we have no idea, not one clue, as to where the hell he is." "It's not that I'm scared for myself," I started to say. "It's all right if you are." "I just don't want to do anything to make it worse," I repeated. That, of course, was always the risk when one was creative or aggressive in an investigation. The perpetrator was never completely predictable. Maybe it was simply something I sensed, an intuitive vibration I was picking up deep inside. But I felt that this killer was different and motivated by something beyond our ken. I feared he knew exactly what we were doing and was enjoying himself. "Now, tell me about you," I said. "Janet was here." "I don't want to get into it." Cold fury crept into her tone. "I have better ways to spend my time." "I'm with you, Lucy. Whatever you want to do." "That much, I've always been sure of. And this much everybody else can be sure of. No matter what it takes, Carrie's going to rot in jail and hell after that." The nurse had returned to my room to whisk the telephone away again. "I don't understand this," I complained as I hung up. "I have a calling card, if that's what you're worried about." She smiled. "Colonel's orders. He wants you to rest and knows you won't if you can be on the phone all day." "I am resting," I said. But she was gone. I wondered why he allowed me to keep the laptop and was suspicious Lucy or someone had spoken to him. As I logged onto AOL, I felt conspired against. I had barely entered the ME chat room when Dead Doc appeared. This time, not as an invisible instant message, but as a member who could be heard and seen by anybody else who decided to walk in. "Dead Doc, where have you been?" "Scarpetta, who are you?" "Dead Doc, I've already told you that." "Scarpetta, you are not me." "Dead Doc, he gave them power over unclean spirits, to cast them out, and to heal all manner of sickness
and all manner of disease, pathophysiological manifestations, viruses like HIV, our Darwinian struggle against them. They are evil, or are we? Scarpetta. Explain what you mean. Dead Doc. There are 12.
But he had no intention of explaining, at least not now. The system alerted me that he had left the room. I waited inside it a while longer to see if he might return, as I wondered what he meant by 12. Pushing a button on my headboard, I summoned the nurse, who was beginning to cause me guilt. I didn't know where she waited outside the room, or if she climbed in and out of her blue suit every time she appeared and left. But none of this could have been pleasant, including my disposition. "Listen," I said when she got to me. "Might there be a Bible around here somewhere?" She hesitated, as if she'd never heard of such a thing.
"Gee, now, that I don't know. Could you check? Are you feeling all right?"
She looked suspiciously at me.
"Absolutely. They've got a library. Maybe there's one in there somewhere. I'm sorry. I'm not very religious."
She continued talking as she went out again. She returned maybe half an hour later with a black leather-bound Bible, Cambridge Red Letter Edition, that she claimed to have borrowed from someone's office. I opened it and found a name in front written in calligraphy, and a date that showed the Bible had been given to its owner on a special occasion almost 10 years before. As I began to turn its pages, I realized I hadn't been to Mass in months. I envied people with a faith so strong that they kept their Bibles at work.
"Now, you're sure you're feeling okay?" said the nurse as she hovered near the door.
"You've never told me your name," I said.
"Sally."
"You've been very helpful, and I certainly appreciate it. I know it's no fun working on Thanksgiving."
This seemed to please her a great deal, and gave her enough confidence to say, "I haven't wanted to poke my nose into anything, but I can't help but hear what people are talking about. That island in Virginia where your case came from? All they do is crabbing there?"
"Pretty much," I said.
"Blue crab.
And soft-shell crab.
Anybody bothering to worry about that?"
I knew what she was getting at, and yes, I was worried. I had a personal reason to be worried about Wesley and me.
"They ship those things all over the country, right?" she went on.
I nodded.
"What if whatever that lady had is transmitted through water or food?"
Her eyes were bright behind her hood.
"I didn't see her body, but I heard. That's really scary."
"I know," I said. "I hope we can get an answer to that soon. By the way, lunch is turkey. Don't expect much."
She unplugged her airline and stopped talking. Opening the door, she gave me a little wave and went out. I turned back to the concordance and had to search for a while under various words before I found the passage Dead Doc had quoted to me. It was Matthew 10, verse 1, and in its entirety it read, "And when he had called unto him his 12 disciples, he gave them power against unclean spirits, to cast them out, and to heal all manner of sickness and all manner of disease." The next verse went on to identify the disciples by name, and then Jesus invoked them to go out and find lost sheep, and to preach to them that the kingdom of heaven was at hand. He directed his disciples to heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. As I read, I didn't know if this killer who called himself Dead Doc had a message he believed, if 12 referred to the disciples, or if he was simply playing games. I got up and paced, looked out the window as light waned. Night came early now, and it had become a habit for me to watch people walk out to their cars. Their breath was frosted, and the lot was almost empty because of the furlough. Two women chatted while one held open the door to a Honda, and they shrugged and gestured with intensity, as if trying to resolve life's big problems. I stood looking through blinds until they drove away. I tried to go to sleep early to escape, but I was fitful again, rearranging myself and the covers every few hours. Images floated past the inside of my eyelids, projected like old movies, unedited and illogically arranged. I saw two women talking by a mailbox. One had a mole on her cheek that became eruptions all over her face as she shielded her eyes with a hand. Then palm trees were writhing in fierce winds as a hurricane roared in from the sea, fronds ripped off and flying, a trunk stripped bare, a bloody table lined with severed hands and feet. I sat up, sweating, and waited for my muscles to stop twitching. It was as if there were an electrical disturbance in my entire system, and I might have a heart attack or a stroke. Taking deep, slow breaths, I blanked out my mind. I did not move. When the vision had passed, I rang for the nurse. When she saw the look on my face, she didn't argue about the phone. She brought it right away, and I called Marino after she left. "You still in jail?" he said over the line. "I think he killed his guinea pig," I said.
"Whoa! How about starting over again?"
Dead Doc, the woman he shot and dismembered, may have been his guinea pig. Someone he knew and had easy access to.
"I gotta confess, Doc, I got no idea what the hell you're talking about."
I could tell by his tone he was worried about my state of mind. It makes sense that he couldn't look at her. The M.O. makes a lot of sense.
"Now you really got me confused."
"If you wanted to find a way to murder people through a virus," I explained, "first, you would have to figure out a way. The route of transmission, for example. Is it a food, a drink, dust? With smallpox, transmission is airborne, spread by droplets or by fluid from the lesions. The disease can be carried on a person or his clothes."
"Start with this," he said. "Where did this person get the virus to begin with? Not exactly something you order through the mail."
"I don't know. To my knowledge, there are only two places in the world that keep archival smallpox. CDC and a laboratory in Moscow."
"So maybe this is all a Russian plot," he said sardonically.
"Let me give you a scenario," I said. "The killer has a grudge, maybe even some delusion that he has a religious calling to bring back one of the worst diseases this planet has ever known. He's got to figure out a way to randomly infect people and be sure that it can work."
"So he needs a guinea pig," Marino said.
"Yes. And let's suppose he has a neighbor, a relative, someone elderly and not well. Maybe he even takes care of her. What better way to test the virus than on that person? And if it works, you kill her and stage her death to look like something else. After all, he certainly can't have her die of smallpox. Not if there's a connection between him and her. We might figure out who he is.
So, he shoots her in the head, dismembers her so we'll think it's the serial killings again.
Then, how do you get from that to the lady on Tangier?
She was exposed, I simply said.
How? Was something delivered to her? Did she get something in the mail? Was it carried on the air? Was she pricked in her sleep?
I don't know how.
You think Dead Doc lives on Tangier?
Marino then asked.
No, I don't, I said. I think he picked it because the island is the perfect place to start an epidemic. Small, self-contained. Also easy to quarantine, meaning the killer doesn't intend to annihilate all of society with one blow. He's trying a little bit at a time, cutting us up in small pieces.
Yeah, like he did the old lady, if you're right.
He wants something, I said. Tangier is an attention getter.
No offense, Doc, but I hope you're wrong about all of this.
I'm heading to Atlanta in the morning. How about checking with Bander? See if he's had any luck with the thumbprint.
So far, he hasn't.
It's looking like the victim doesn't have any prints on file.
Anything comes up, I'll call your pager.
Damn, I muttered, for the nurse had taken that, too.
The rest of the day moved interminably slowly, and it wasn't until after supper that Fujitsubo came to say goodbye. Although the act of releasing me implied I was neither infected nor infectious, he was in a blue suit, which he plugged into an airline.
"I should keep you longer," he said right off, filling my heart with dread. "Incubation on average is 12 to 13 days, but it can be as long as 21. What I'm saying to you is that you could still get sick."
"I understand that," I said, reaching for my water.
"The revaccination may or may not help, depending on what stage you were in when I gave it to you."
I nodded.
"And I wouldn't be in such a hurry to leave if you would just take this on instead of sending me to CDC.
"Kay, I can't."
His voice was muffled through plastic. "You know it has nothing to do with what I feel like doing. But I can no more pull something out from under CDC than you can grab a case that isn't your jurisdiction. I've talked to them. They are most concerned over a possible outbreak and will begin testing the moment you arrive with the samples. I fear terrorism may be involved."
I refuse to back down.
"Until there is evidence of it, and I hope there won't be, we can do nothing more for you here."
His regret was sincere.
"Go to Atlanta and see what they have to say. They're operating with a skeleton crew, too. The timing couldn't be worse."
"Or perhaps more deliberate," I said. "If you were a bad person planning to commit serial crimes with a virus, what better time than when the significant federal health agencies are in extremis? And this furlough's been going on for a while and not predicted to end anytime soon."
He was silent. "John," I went on, "you helped with the autopsy. Have you ever seen a disease like this?"
"Only in textbooks,"
he grimly replied. "How does smallpox suddenly just reappear on its own?"
"If that's what it is."
"Whatever it is, it's virulent and it kills."
I tried to reason with him. But he could do nothing more, and the rest of the night I wandered from room to room in AOL. Every hour, I checked my email. Dead Doc remained silent until 6 o'clock the next morning when he walked into the ME room. My heart jumped as his name appeared on screen. My adrenaline began to pump the way it always did when he talked to me.
He was on the line.
It was up to me.
I could catch him if only I could trip him.
Dead Doc. Sunday, I went to church.
Bet you didn't.
Scarpetta.
What was the homily about?
Dead Doc.
Sermon.
Scarpetta.
You are not Catholic.
Dead Doc.
Beware of men.
Scarpetta.
Matthew 10.
Tell me what you mean.
Dead Doc.
To say he's sorry.
Scarpetta.
Who is he?
And what did he do?
Dead Doc.
Ye shall indeed drink of the cup that I drink of.
Before I could answer, he was gone, and I began flipping through the Bible. The verse he quoted this time was from Mark, and again it was Jesus speaking, which hinted to me, if nothing else, that Dead Doc wasn't Jewish. Nor was he Catholic, based on his comments about church. I was no theologian, but drinking of the cup seemed to refer to Christ's eventual crucifixion. So Dead Doc had been crucified, and I would be too? It was my last few hours here, and my nurse, Sally, was more liberal with the phone. I paged Lucy, who called me back almost instantly.
I'm talking to him, I said. Are you guys there?
We're there. He's got to stay on longer, my niece said. There are so many trunk lines, and we got to line up all the phone companies to trap and trace. Your last call was coming in from Dallas.
You're kidding, I said in dismay.
That's not the origin, just a switch it was routed through. We didn't get any farther because he disconnected. Keep trying.
Sounds like this guy's some kind of religious nut.
Chapter 11.
Later that morning, I left in a taxi as the sun was getting high in the clouds. I had nothing but the clothes on my back, all of which had been sterilized in the autoclave or gassed. I was in a hurry, and guarding a large white cardboard box printed with "Perishable, Rush, Rush," and "Important, Keep Upright," and other big blue warnings. Like a Chinese puzzle, my package was boxes within boxes containing biopacks. Inside these were biotubes of Lila Pruitt's liver, spleen, and spinal fluid, protected by fiberboard shields and bubble and corrugated wrap. All of it was packed in dry ice with infectious substance and danger stickers, warning anyone who got beyond the first layer. Obviously, I couldn't let my cargo out of sight. In addition to its well-proven hazard, it could be evidence, should it turn out that Pruitt was a homicide. At the Baltimore-Washington International Airport, I found a payphone and called Rose. Yus Amred has my medical bag and microscope. I didn't waste time. See what you can do about getting them shipped overnight. I'm at BWI en route to CDC.
I've been trying to page you, she said.
Maybe they can return that to me, too. I tried to remember what else I was missing. And the phone, I added.
You got a report back that you might find interesting. The animal hairs that turned up with the torso. Rabbit and monkey hairs.
Bizarre, was the only thing I could think to say.
I hate to tell you this news. The media's been calling about the Carrie Grethen case. Apparently, something's been leaked.
God damn it, I exclaimed as I thought about Ring.
What do you want me to do?
She asked.
How about calling Benton? I don't know what to say.
I'm a little overwhelmed.
You sound that way.
I looked at my watch. Rose, I've got to fight my way on a plane. They didn't want to let me through X-ray, and I know what's going to happen when I try to board with this thing. It was exactly what I expected. When I walked into the cabin, a flight attendant took one look and
smiled.
Here, she held out her
hands. Let me put this in baggage for
you. It's got to stay with me, I said.
It won't fit in an overhead rack or under your seat, ma'am.
Her smile got tight, the line behind me getting longer. Can we discuss this out of traffic? I said, moving into the kitchen. She was right next to me, hovering close.
Ma'am, this flight is overbooked. We simply don't have room.
Here, I said, showing her the paperwork. Her eyes scanned the red-bordered Declaration for Dangerous Goods and froze halfway down a column where it was typed that I was transporting infectious substances affecting humans. She glanced nervously around the kitchen and moved me closer to the restrooms. Regulations require that only a trained person can handle dangerous goods like these, I reasonably explained. So it has to stay with me.
What is it?
She whispered, her eyes round. Autopsy specimens.
Mother of God.
She immediately grabbed her seating chart. Soon after, I was escorted to an empty row in first class, near the back.
Just put it on the seat next to you. It's not going to leak or anything, she asked.
I'll guard it with my life. I promised.
We should have a lot of vacancies up here, unless a bunch of people upgrade. But don't you worry. I'll steer everyone.
She motioned with her arms, as if she were driving. No one came near me or my box. I drank coffee during a very peaceful flight to Atlanta, feeling naked without my pager or phone, but overjoyed to be on my own. In the Atlanta airport, I took one moving sidewalk and escalator after another, traveling what seemed miles before I got outside and found a taxi. We followed 85 North to Druid Hills Road, where soon we were passing pawn shops and auto rentals, then vast jungles of poison oak and kudzu, and strip malls. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was in the midst of the parking decks and parking lots of Emory University. Across the street from the American Cancer Society, CDC was six floors of tan brick, trimmed with gray. I checked in at a desk that had guards and closed-circuit TV. This is going to Bio Level 4, where I'm meeting Dr. Brett Martin in the atrium, I explained.
Ma'am, you'll need an escort, one of the guards said.
Good, I said, as he reached for the phone. I always get lost. I followed him to the back of the building, where the facility was new and under intense surveillance. There were cameras everywhere, the glass bulletproof, and corridors were catwalks with grated floors. We passed bacteria and influenza labs, and the red brick and concrete area for rabies and AIDS.
This is impressive, I said,
for I hadn't been here in several years.
Yeah, it is. They got all the security you might want. Cameras, motion detectors at all exits and entrances. All the trash is boiled and burned. And they use these filters for the air so anything that comes in is killed, except the scientists.
He laughed as he used a card key to open a door.
So what bad news you carrying in?
That's what I'm here to find out, I said. And we were in the atrium now. BL-4 was really nothing more than a huge laminar flow hood with thick walls of concrete and steel. It was a building within a building, its windows covered with blinds. Labs were behind thick walls of glass,
and the only blue-suited scientists working this furloughed day were those who had cared enough to come in anyway.
"This thing with the government," the guard was saying as he shook his head. "What they think? These diseases like Ebola gonna wait until the budget gets straight?"
He shook his head some more. He escorted me past containment rooms that were dark, and labs with no one in them, then empty rabbit cages in a corridor and rooms for large primates. A monkey looked at me through bars and glass, his eyes so human they unnerved me. And I thought of what Rose had said. Dead Doc had transferred monkey and rabbit hairs to a victim I knew he had touched. He might work in a place like this.
"They throw waste at you," the guard said as we walked on. "Same thing their animal rights activists do. Kind of fits, don't you think?"
My anxiety was getting stronger. "Where are we going?" I asked.
"Where the good doctor told me to bring you, ma'am," he said.
And we were on another level of catwalk now, heading into another part of the building. We passed through a door, where Revco ultra-low-temperature freezers looked like computers the size of large copying machines. They were locked and out of place in this corridor, where a heavy man in a lab coat was waiting for me. He had baby-fine blonde hair and was perspiring. "I'm Brett Martin," he said, offering me his hand. "Thanks." He nodded at the guard, indicating he was dismissed. I handed Martin my cardboard box. "This is where we keep our smallpox stock," he said, nodding at the freezers as he set my box on top of one of them. "Locked up at 70 degrees centigrade below zero. What can I say?" He shrugged. "These freezers are out in the hall because we have no room anyplace else in maximum containment. Rather coincidental you should give this to me. Not that I'm expecting your disease to be the same." "All of this is smallpox?" I asked, amazed as I looked around. "Not all, and not for long, though, since for the first time ever on this planet, we've made a conscious decision to eliminate a species." "The irony," I said, "when the species you're talking about has eliminated millions." "So you think we should just take all this source disease and autoclave it?" His expression said what I was used to hearing. Life was much more complicated than I presented it, and only people like him recognized the subtler shades. "I'm not saying we should destroy anything," I replied. "Not at all. Actually, probably we shouldn't. Because of this." I looked at the box I had just given him. "Our autoclaving smallpox certainly won't mean it's gone. I guess it's like any other weapon." "You and me both. I'd sure like to know where the Russians are hiding their variola stock virus these days, and if they've sold any of it to the Middle East, North Korea."
"You'll do PCR on this?" I said.
"Yes."
"Right away?"
"As fast as we can."
"Please," I said. "This is an emergency."
"That's why I'm standing here now," he said. "The government considers me non-essential. I should be at home."
I've got photographs that Use Amrid was kind enough to develop while I was in the slammer, I said with a trace of irony.
"I want to see them."
We took the elevator back up, getting off on the fourth floor. He led me into a conference room where staff met to devise strategies against terrible scourges they couldn't always identify. Usually, bacteriologists, epidemiologists,
people in charge of quarantines, communications, special pathogens, and PCR assembled in the room. But it was quiet. No one was here but us.
"Right now," Martin said, "I'm all you've got."
I got a thick envelope out of my purse, and he began to go through the photographs. For a moment, he stared as if transfixed at color prints of the torso and those of Lila Pruitt.
"Good God," he said. "I think we should look at transpiration routes right away. Everybody who might have had contact. And I mean fast."
"We can do that on Tangier," I said.
"Maybe."
"Definitely not chicken pox or measles." "No way, Jose," he said.
"Definitely pox-related."
He went through photographs of the severed hands and feet, his eyes wide.
"Wow."
He stared without blinking, light reflecting on his glasses.
"What the hell is this?"
"He calls himself Dead Doc," I said. "He sent me graphic files through AOL. Anonymously, of course. The FBI's trying to track him."
"And this victim here, he dismembered?"
I nodded.
"She also has manifestations similar to the victim on Tangier."
He was looking at vesicles on the torso. "So far, yes."
"You know, monkeypox has been worrying me for years," he said. "We survey the hell out of West Africa, from Zaire to Sierra Leone, where cases have occurred, along with white pox. But so far, no variola virus has turned up. My fear, though, is that one of these days some pox virus in the animal kingdom is going to figure out a way to infect people."
Again, I thought about my telephone conversation with Rose, about murder and animal hairs.
"All that's got to happen is the microorganism gets in the air, let's say, and finds a susceptible host."
He went back to Lila Pruitt, to her disfigured, tormented body on her foul bed.
"Now, she was obviously exposed to enough virus to cause devastating disease," he said.
And he was so engrossed, he seemed to be talking to himself.